nights now, I have been reading from G. Campbell Morgan's third volume, The Preaching of G. Campbell Morgan, The Westminster Pulpit. His sermons as he preached them. And in this volume, he preached a series on the problems of the religious life. Subtitled, The Opposing Forces of the Religious Life. The world, the flesh, and the devil. The first night, I took his third one, the devil, because that's your biggest problem. The last night, I took his message on the world. Any student of any subject is going to build upon the research of those that have gone before. And hopefully go a little beyond it. I want to go a little beyond what he had to say about the world. As good as he was in defining the world, he pretty much limited it to temporal and spatial things. And he made the point that these three together provide the threat. Satan using the world and the flesh. And as I said last night, Martin Luther thought there was no such thing as free will. You're either under the control of the world, the flesh, and the devil, or you're under the control of the deliverer, God through his spirit. And it's a rescue action that's going on. And the world and the flesh and the devil do not let go easily. You have a margin of freedom. You can choose to resist the rescue. You can choose not to cooperate with the rescue. Or with God's help, you can resist the elements that would drag you back. But one of the other forces is going to take you into possession. You'll either be a slave of God or a slave of the world, the flesh, and the devil. And the world is more than temporal and spatial things. Cosmos, the Greek word, also means coming from a concept of order, the frame of reference of the world, the order that they choose to identify with, the order that they project and will love you if you'll support them in the order of things as they embrace it. It's a frame of reference, a manner of living, a manner of seeing, a way of doing, that Jesus is talking about when he says, if ye were of the world, cosmos, the world would love it its own, but you're not of the world, because I've chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. We're talking about frame of reference, the dimension of projecting your viewpoint into a controlling frame. I agree with G. Campbell Morgan. When you identify with the world and it becomes an end in itself, then you're worldly. But the frame of reference that supports that identity is also the world, the worldview. Now let's talk about flesh. Because of the near personal relation of the flesh to every human being, and I suppose I can't argue with that, This subject is at once supremely interesting and vitally important. The flesh is part of the ego. Part of myself. Not all of myself, but part. And an essential part, so far as the present life is concerned. No argument there. Need flesh to get on. That's why we're so scared of this flesh-eating bacteria. Flesh is important. The world is outside me. The devil is another person other than I am, a distinct personality. But the flesh is of my very self. I cannot escape it. It goes where I go. It abides where I abide. It is with me in my thinking, in my loving, in my willing. I have to take account of the flesh. I may be able to escape in some measure from the world, in cloistered seclusions and within stone walls. And that's where my definition comes in, and from the worldview, I cannot so escape from the flesh. I may be able to escape from the devil in certain surroundings and certain atmospheres. I don't think the devil ever wants God admission into the Holy of Holies and the tabernacle in the wilderness. I mean, in spite of what some people tell you about spirit-filled people being demon-possessed at the same time, it's either or. Spirit-filled people can grieve the spirit, and the spirit will withdraw. And Satan's ever ready to move in this place. Satan, though he wasn't yet spirit-filled, Satan definitely entered Peter. But a strong man, two strong men, not going to dwell in the same house together. So where the Spirit is in you, the devil is not. But the Spirit is capable of being there one day and not being there the next day. And that includes the next moment. When you break the connections of faith. So, yes, there are certain surroundings and certain atmospheres that you can escape from the devil, as you can, in a sense, from the world. I can never escape from the flesh. Not complaining, just testifying. Consequently, I say we're dealing with a subject which is supremely interesting, vitally important. You didn't have to convince me. I'm reading from G. Campbell Morgan. Now I propose to follow, he says, the same line of examination as when I considered the world as an opposing force. First, the flesh in itself. Second, the flesh as opposed to religion. Third, the flesh in relation to the world and the devil. Finally, victory over the flesh. We are greatly aided in the study of the flesh by the incarnation. That ancient doctrine of the church, God was in Christ, reconciling the world, is one of the least understood. And it better be recognized that it's just as blasphemous to deny the humanity of Christ as it is to deny the divinity of Christ. In Christ, you meet God and man, not part God, part man, God and man in all parts, all the time, an existential happening, paradoxical and capable of being embraced in the logical frame in which we grow up. Campbell didn't say this, I'm talking now. Because we grow up in the Aristotelian logic frame, where A cannot be A and not A at the same time. It's either A or it's not A. The incarnation is a paradoxical truth where A and not A is there at the same time. God and not God. Man and not man. Both concurrent, simultaneous, paradoxical, incapable of being embraced in our language philosophic frame, but a declaration of truth supported by the truth of the resurrection, which is logical, that then is embraced in faith. It cannot be made logical. There is God and man in all parts and all ways at the same time. Not sometimes God, sometimes man. All the time God and man. That's the paradox, the miracle of the incarnation. No logical man can accept that prima facie. I accept it because of the resurrection, which is the doorway through which my logical mind could walk. And once the resurrection is accepted, then faith moves to the next step, that God can do what Aristotle could not with reason conceive or understand. Put them both. Happening at the same time. And it's as blasphemous to deny his humanity as to deny his divinity. Back to G. Campbell Morgan. He's a little more direct and simple. Therein, in the incarnation, we see human nature according to the pattern as God intended. True to the ideal, as Adam should have been. We have no real understanding of what was in the heart of God when he said, "Let us make man." He didn't really say man, by the way. He said, "Let us make Adam." I don't have any problem with evolution. I believe that God put a principle in the universe, both faith and unfolding. Evolution is a hypothesis to explain the occurrence of certain facts in paleontology, which studies life forms encased in stone in geology, biological development, plant development, that appears to have a sequence. And evolution is the theory, hypothesis, one, to explain it. Where evolution went bad when they go nuts and decide to take a theory to explain certain facts, primarily based in paleontological development, the formation of layers of what we now call rock, some of which is made up of organic material, and the layers that can be dated on an assumption that the way things happen and change and develop now is the way things always happened and changed and developed. And therefore, if you make that assumption that all things have been developing as we now see them developing, mountains erode and become plains, volcanic eruptions pour out lava, bend the rocks, push the strata up, continents drift, and all of these various elements on the crust of the earth have been going on at the same rate, the same way, then you can plot sequences, and life form seems to go from more simple to more complicated, and they come up with a theory, evolution, to explain it. What do I care? What's that got to do with God? And the price of gold on the streets of heaven. If God could have done it either way. He could have decided to play a game that would keep us arguing and pursuing and hypothesizing by creating it all without appearance. Or he could have done it that way. Or he could have speeded things up and slowed things down with great cataclysms. Doesn't have a damn, sorry, thing to do with... No, not really, sorry. because it fits. Doesn't have a damn thing to do with Adam. Doesn't have a thing to do with Adam. Got it? Yeah, you remember it now. Man-like creatures can be found, and they keep pushing them back as they find a little piece of bone and then build a whole creature off of it. Man-like creatures can be found, and why they spend the money to dig in that great rift in Africa when they could go to Washington, D.C. is beyond me, utterly beyond me. They can find man-like creatures. You're dealing with structure and similarities. But God did not say, let us make man. He said, in the original, let us make Adam. I don't care how many monkey-like men were running around. I don't care how close you come to the missing link. Bureaucrats. You're not going to find a soul encased in a geological strata. You're only going to find structures. And the Bible declares, God said, let us make Adam. And he formed Adam and breathed into him, Ruach, and Adam became a living soul. A whole new creation. Nowhere in the chain. Didn't say, let us make man. Back to G. Campbell Morgan. Let us make man. We have no real understanding of what it was in the heart of God when he said, literally, let us make Adam, until we know Jesus Christ. And Paul calls him the second Adam. We may have studied human nature. We may have studied human history. We may have a large and varied circle of acquaintances and friends. But we never know. I'm going to say Adam. He says man. But we never know Adam until we know Jesus Christ. We never know an offspring of Adam until we know Jesus Christ. In the book of Hebrews, this is not Campbell Morgan. In the book of Hebrews, the writer is amazed. He uses a tripart Greek word, epilambano, three parts, to bend, and to bend down or stoop down with intention, and to bend or stoop down with intention to help. The writer amazed that God did not bend with the purpose, and that purpose being to help. He did not do that with fallen angels. He did it with fallen man. And the way he did it is Jesus the Christ, the Son of God, who did not share flesh and blood as we do. We don't have a choice, as this opening by Morgan said. We are flesh and blood. He was not. He chose to bend down with the purposeful intent to help by clothing himself and choosing to take on flesh and blood, that to link the vast array of Scripture that always interweaves together, that in the type of the kinsman redeemer, as I taught some many Sundays back, he became kin with us, which is the meaning of Christmas, whatever date you pick for it. He voluntarily chose to become as we are, bound to flesh and blood. He took it upon himself. And to see what it ought to look like, ought to be like, indeed ought to be, you'll never know until you know Jesus Christ. He is graciously and wonderfully, back to Morgan, it is graciously and wonderfully true that he is the revelation of God. It is equally and as graciously true that he is the revelation of man. You want to know man? You start with him. Adam is man's guard and failed. Jesus Christ is man as he should be. I know the meaning of this life of mine only when I know Jesus. Through all the ages, so far as I may glance at them through the windows of history, secular and sacred, I see man after man, some rising above their fellows, conspicuous heights among the mountains, but I never know what Adam is or what man as God created descendants of Adam, what man is according to the divine pattern until my eyes rest on the one man, the one descendant of Adam, who, as Paul called him, is the second Adam, the one man of Nazareth. I could leave Campbell Morgan here and say this man characterized himself above all other things. He denied himself and became obedient unto death. Even the death of the cross, that shameful death. Self-seeking behavior of a man clothed in flesh is the antithesis of Jesus the Christ. Back to Morgan. I know the meaning of this life of mine only when I know Jesus. Through all the ages, so far as I may glance at them through the windows of history, secular and sacred, I repeat, I see man after man, some rising above their fellows, conspicuous heights among the mountains, but I never know what man is according to the divine pattern until my eyes rest on the one man of Nazareth. In him, we are able to understand, as we never could apart from that revelation, the failure of all other men. Had there been no Jesus Christ in the world and no record of him, no image of him stamped on the human consciousness, I can conceive that men might be very well satisfied with themselves. But no man who has honestly studied the portrait of Jesus, which the Gospels present, who has stood face to face with the man of Nazareth and allowed him to put the measurement of himself upon life, has escaped the conviction that he ought to say, "Lo, I've sinned." That's why Paul calls sin hamartia, falling short. Obedience unto death. My meat is to do the will of the Father that sent me. I know the kinship between Jesus and myself. But it is when I am most conscious of the kinship that I discover the immeasurable, appalling, and awful distance between him and myself. The distance would not appall me if there were no kinship. But it is when I know he is flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone, blood of my blood, and then see him rising into the infinite heights, towering above me, in his fulfillment of the ideal, using the flesh, making it his servant, giving himself to the will of God. His fulfillment of the ideal, in simple sublimity of his realization of purpose, by contrast, I know how low I've fallen. Now, in the light of that revelation, we turn to our consideration. The first necessity is that we should understand the meaning of the term flesh, knowing that he became flesh for our sake, and he conquered it. And it's one of the three basic elements that war in combo against the God-ordered, God-committed life. So it's necessary we should understand the meaning of the term flesh. There are two brief passages which I'm going to quote in order that their light may fall on the subject, and then a third. And if you want to hear, you stay tuned, get on the telephone, we're going through station break. The first is that we should understand the meaning of the term, the flesh. There are two brief passages which I'm going to quote in order that their light may fall on the subject. The first is to be found in the opening chapter of John's Gospel. The Word was made flesh. I can tell you that's John 1:14. Four words in the Greek. Ho logos, sarx, egeneto. Literally, the Word flesh became. But it's a military word, I can tell you. Used to strike a tent. When they strike a tent and move in. Geneto. He struck a tent in human flesh and moved in. The Word became flesh. The second is to be found in the first letter of the same writer, in the fourth chapter, that is in the first epistle of John, who wrote the Gospel. Fourth chapter, verse 2. One thing that irritates me when I read Morgan's messages, you've got to go hunt and look up the verses when he quotes them, because he never gives you a reference. There, John says, Jesus Christ is come in the flesh. In sarkai, elalu, thota. Literally, in flesh having come. It's certain that flesh, in the first and simplest condition, therefore, since the Word was made flesh, or the Word flesh became, and Jesus Christ is come in the flesh, then it's certain, just as we talked about the world. And the only limitation I'd put on what Morgan said about the world is not inherently evil. But the world, when the phrase is being used, cosmos, is being used to describe the worldly view, it has become evil, that view. But likewise, the flesh, I mean, there are a lot of Christians being motivated to beat on the flesh. And you carnal ones, enjoy your own interpretation of what I've said and then come back to where I am. The flesh is just all evil, and anything that feels good is a sin. Because the flesh is to be crucified. No, the flesh is to be crucified only when it fulfills God's purposes. You'd go out and crucify yourself, 100 of you, and it wouldn't save a donkey. Christ's purpose was to bring his flesh into God's dominion and offer his flesh in our place. So his crucifixion, the death of the cross, had a saving purpose. But these Christians who tell you that the flesh is inherently evil and you've got to beat it up all the time are full of it, clerically said. the Word was made flesh, and Jesus Christ has come in the flesh, and He became our kinsman redeemer because He chose to move into flesh. So flesh, in the first and simplest condition, I agree and quote Morgan, is not sinful. That means it's not a sin to be hungry and eat. You do not sin when you get some fleshly relief, which means, at the very least, going to sleep. I'm going to lose you before I get very much further if I don't just read Morgan. There's nothing inherently sinful in flesh. Whoopee! There is another passage in Romans. Romans 8:3. But notice very carefully what it really says concerning Jesus. He was made, quote, in the likeness of sinful flesh. The Greek, in likeness of flesh of sin. I read my notes in the margin of Morgan's message. I wrote the Greek so small I got to put my glasses on. In homo, or homoi, omati, sarkos, hamartika, or hamartias, rather. Hamartia, you know that word. It's to fall short. It's the New Testament definition of sin. Short falling. All have sinned, fallen short. And they've fallen short of the glory of God. Hebrews says Jesus was the outraying of God's glory. As the light is there, God, and the ray reaches me, Jesus was that outraying of God's glory. And we see that stamp in seven great statements in Hebrews 1. All of these things are said. He was the outraying of God's glory. He was the proof coin struck in human flesh. You who collect coins know the difference between a proof that's not been damaged and coins that are subsequent stamps. This is a proof coin in human flesh. Of God's image. This Christ in the flesh was made in the likeness of flesh of sin, in the likeness of flesh that falls short. But He didn't fall short. He was not made sinning flesh. He was made flesh. He was made in the likeness of sinning flesh. But He being the proof coin, we all fall short. He was made in the likeness of sinning flesh. He was not made, back to Morgan, sinful flesh, but in the likeness of it. He was made flesh, but not sinful flesh. You're recognizing the presence of something in the flesh that does not belong to it, that ought not to be there. Sinning. Sin. I lay my hand on this hand of mine. I touch this body of mine. I handle and touch sinful flesh. But when the disciples in the olden days laid their hand on the actual flesh of the man of Nazareth, they laid their hand on actual flesh also, but not on sinful flesh. And so I look at this man, the ideal man, the actual man, this sinless man, the man who challenged any to convince him of sin or convict him of sin, this man who claimed absolute holiness. And as I look, I know that the flesh in its first and simplest condition is not sinful. Jesus is the proof coin. There can be flesh without sin. You'll never see it again on this earth. It was never seen before. And that handwriting of ordinances, that law that was the schoolmaster to teach that Satan was a liar, who said when they rebelled against God, they would not die and that they would be like God, and that knowledge of good and evil would be sufficient to make them like God. No. All have sinned and come short of God's standard, and he revealed that standard to Moses through the hand of angels. And that handwriting of ordinances, the law, was God's abstract standard of perfection. And he said, those who live in it will live. Those who don't, or who miss, or fall short of it, die. And the law required perfection. You couldn't miss a jot or tittle. Perpetuality. Couldn't miss it for a second. Keep it 99% of your life and miss it for a minute. You were not judged by what you knew about it. God's standard was not dependent upon your knowledge. So that's why God in the Old Testament, pointing to Christ, had to have a type, an offering for the sins of ignorance. We can't even know God's standard every moment of our life. And yet one small deviation, one miss, makes you fall short of it. The miss, the falling short, is the same for a bare miss as a wide miss. It had to be personal. If you lived it, you live. You miss it for a second, or you miss one jot or tittle, whether ignorant or not, death is your lot. And that law could not pass away till every jot and tittle was fulfilled. Christ incarnate in the flesh had to keep the law, not sin. He was in the likeness of sinning flesh. He didn't sin. He was the law then incarnate. The law from a standard written on stones and uttered by prophets and inscribed by scribes to be perpetuated as tradition, came into a tent of human flesh and was lived out in the flesh of Jesus. His was flesh without sin. In the likeness of sinning flesh, he didn't sin. And in so doing, fulfilled the law until it's incarnate and fulfilled in this one person. And when he was nailed to the tree, it died with him. But he is the proof. There can be flesh without sin. What then, according to that first divine intention of God, of what man should be? As revealed in Jesus, what then is the flesh? The idea is the instrument of the Spirit. That's what God intended. God breathed into man a dimension of being, dwelling in, tied to, but not destined forever to be flesh and blood. And the flesh was intended by God, according to Morgan, I agree with him, as the instrument of the Spirit, that dimension of being that made Adam different. That part of God, the imageness of God that was breathed into Adam and made him a living soul. The flesh then is the instrument of the spirit, perfectly adjusted to the material underworld and to the spirit overworld. Reinhold Niebuhr put it in more sophisticated terms. The self, the essential self, the living soul self, the spirit self that God breathed into man, the image of God he placed in man, is a resident of both time and eternity, inextricably, temporarily tied to this spatial, temporal house, but with memory and with imagination, with fantasy and with dreams, also a denizen of eternity, tied like a tether to a stake. We can transcend this spatial, temporal body that is our house. That's what makes us a spirit person. And this flesh is to be an instrument under the control of that spirit. Man, who is not a body, but who is a spirit inhabiting a body, not just a body, but a spirit inhabiting a body, is able to touch all the material, all the world, through the medium of his flesh. When the psalmist, referring to the flesh, to the body, said, quote, "We are fearfully and wonderfully made," he uttered a tremendous truth. Through the medium of the flesh, man has been able to examine and discover and manipulate to exercise the dominion for which he was created. The body is God's created perfect instrument of the Spirit. Not the goal of Christianity to disembody you immediately. That's a Vedanta faith out of which Buddhism comes, to get you out of the wheel of life and become that with the that which is behind everything. A trance-like state of nothingness where you're not identified with the things of time. And the body is essentially evil, victim of its karma. And nirvana is to escape from that wheel of life. Nonsense. Not Christian. The body was created by God. He breathed his life in it. He chose to put man's spirit in this house. And Jesus proves the flesh can be subservient to the spirit under the control of God. But his was the only perfect one, flesh without sin. The body is intended by God to be the perfect instrument of the Spirit, subservient to it, answering it, the medium through which the Spirit touches all lower creation, just as God stepped forth from behind the curtain of eternity and mystery, struck a tent in human flesh, and brought God's nature into the streets where ordinary people live and move and have their being.
This is the end of side one. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side two.